then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's September the 13th, 1914. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, this week I want to start out with some housekeeping stuff, which is basically what I call the little I'm doing these days by way of organizing. Now, we're still waiting for someone who is qualified and who is willing to make TLC, Total Life Commitment to the Northwest Republic, to step forward and act as national organizer, and so I'm just kind of puttering around with it one or two days per week. First, this is from Billy in, I believe, Tennessee, although I'm not certain. Dear HAC, I have two questions. Number one, can I make a donation to the Northwest Front? And two, where can I buy copies of the White Book? Signed, Billy. Yes, Billy, you most certainly can make a donation to the Northwest Front. You'll need to email me privately at nwnet@earthlink.net, and I'll give you the details. The best way to make a donation to the Northwest Front is to take out a subscription to Northwest Observer, our party's monthly 16-page magazine or newsletter. I personally think 16 pages qualifies as a small magazine, but to each his own. The Northwest Observer comes out pretty much around the first of every month. I've never missed a print deadline during the 6 years I've been publishing the magazine. It is based very loosely on an old publication that some of the really, really old-timers among you may remember and called the South African Observer. It was published in Pretoria back in the apartheid days by an old gentleman named S.E.D. Brown. And one of these days, I think somebody needs to really write a biography of Mr. Brown and tell about some of the things he got into because he was a fascinating character. I take great pride in always meeting my deadlines and getting Northwest Observer printed and stuffed and in the mail by the deadline on the 1st. The only time we ever missed an issue was in June of 2009, and that was taken up by a special mailing of leaflet templates. We are one of the last movement groups that maintains a printed publication at all and which has not gone completely internet. We do this for a couple of reasons. First off, believe it or not, there are still people out there who don't own computers and who are reliant on printed publications. Now, this group consists of prisoners, of course, as well as a lot of elderly people who don't understand computers and never bothered to get one, and also a lot of people who, after spending some time, sometimes years, online, made a deliberate and conscious decision to take their computers apart and put them back in the box and not to have these machines in their lives, which is a decision I can very much applaud and one I wish I was able to make myself. So, let me hear from you at nwnet@earthlink.net, and I'll fill you in on more details, but basically, a subscription to Northwest Observer is $30 per year and $50 per year for overseas airmail. Now, you should make your checks and money orders payable to Northwest Publishing Agency. Now to the second part of Billy's email question. You can buy the Northwest novels, and in fact most of my novels, all over the internet. You can order them directly from the publishers, and if you want to email me at the above address I just gave you, I will send you that information. But there's really no need, because right now print per order has expanded to the point where all kinds of outlets and retailers and subcontractors and whatnot are doing it. And if you shop around, you can even get some interesting bargains, like $2 to $4 off the publisher's price per an individual copy. I found brigade copies offered online, allegedly new, i.e. printed per order, for as low as $16. The main online sources for all Covington books, not just the Northwest novels, are Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and Alibris.com, that's Alibris.com. Many of them by now are available as ebooks and Kindle, especially from Amazon. But I know a lot of you old-timers out there still believe a book should be read while being held in the hand and not on an electronic screen. Now, this doesn't apply so much to Freedom's Sons and the White Book, which is what Billy asked about. These are available for direct online order from lulu.com, that's L-U-L-U.com, and also from me. For some reason, lulu.com is not connected with the rest of the print-per-order industry, at least not very well that I've noticed, and so those two books don't pop up when you do searches on Libris.com and whatnot like all the others. If you want your books signed by me, then once again, that email address is nwnet@earthlink.net, and I'll send you the details. Please don't be too upset if you don't get a reply for a few days. I'm only logging into that account about twice a week now to try and free up time to finish Freedom's Sons, although that is proving to be a very hard resolution to keep. God damn, these machines are as addictive as potato chips. Okay, now, this next comment of mine is not an answer to anyone's email, but I'm going to discuss a problem which has come up from time to time over the past 10 years or so, ever since we've had our comrades designing their own Northwest literature and websites. Now, this problem applies to business cards, leaflets, YouTube videos, and internet images, anything that our people design and distribute themselves. But I think it's something I need to comment on just generically here. Not talking about anyone in particular, okay? Are we clear on this? I'm not dressing anybody down or putting anybody down or making digs at anybody. I'm simply making a general observation based on past experience. Everybody got their arms wrapped around that. Movement, thin skins and feathers all soothed and smoothed. Okay. Guys, when designing your own literature for the Northwest Front and the Northwest Migration, be it small handheld items or on a website or a YouTube or whatever, we need a moratorium on images of Arno Breker nude sculptures from the Third Reich era in Germany and on all classical nude statuary from the Greek and Roman eras. Matter of fact, we need to have a moratorium on nude anything in our material. Remember, guys, this is America, and however popular we may be in Europe, especially in Sweden for some reason, it is Americans we're dealing with as our target audience. With Americans, never forget how low you have to shoot in order to get a hit. Now, guys, I'm a National Socialist. I understand the Aryan ideals of beauty and spiritual strength that the sculptor Arno Breker was trying to convey with his statuary in the context of his time and place in Europe. To Europeans. Americans see only naked people.
Golly, Jimmy Bob, look at that. That woman ain't got no clothes on.
It's even worse with the male statuary, including absolute classical masterpieces like the ancient Laocoon group and Michelangelo's David.
Hey, Vern, that feller's got his Johnson bar hanging out.
Americans just don't get it. They are incapable of getting it, and they can't be changed. We can't have this kind of graphics on Northwest literature, however much I may get your intentions, and however much in good faith those intentions are. This especially applies to the male statuary. We have enough problems as it is with this movement attracting faggots without inadvertently encouraging it. And even if we don't draw faggots by using Brecker's male work on our material, to the average American idiot in the street who picks up the leaflet or goes to an allegedly NF-related website, it will look like we are trying to attract faggots. Like I said, guys, Americans just don't get it. They don't see art. They see David's willy. I'm sorry we're such a trashy people, but we are, and the party has to put itself on a credible basis of communication with the people it is trying to convert. They are not going to listen to our ideas if they are distracted by looking at naked bodies, even works of genius like Brecker's. Dear Mr. Covington, I am from Kent in southeast England. Multiracialists give me the usual crap that all whites are originally from Africa and that white nationalists are wrong for wanting to kick out non-whites and oppose miscegenation between whites and blacks. So, how do you respond to them? Best regards, Michael. First off, Michael, don't respond to them. Never argue with liberals or reds because they will not change their opinion absent physical compulsion. And certainly never argue or debate with Jews or non-whites, because they can't change what they are. Until such time as we stop trying to fight with words and start fighting with rifles, explosives, and petrol bombs, whenever that day may come, you should concentrate on speaking only to our own people, who are still sufficiently mushy in their heads to be maybe persuadable, as well as, of course, those whites who display some sense of injustice or racial resentment or rebellion. Secondly, about 2 years ago or so, I went into my own theories about our racial origins on this program, and it sparked a good deal of interest, and we got into the whole Christian identity, religious thing about Adamic man and the 10 lost tribes and so forth and so on, and I really, at this point, think we need to concentrate more on what's going to happen over the next few months than on where we came from. Now, there's a time and place for that, and indeed, Section 3 of Freedom's Sons revolves around the whole Salutrian thing. But briefly put, my own personal belief is this, and I don't insist on it, it's just me here, okay? So don't rant and rave and claim that I'm offending anybody's religion, or trying to make myself out to be a prophet, or, you know, L. Ron Hubbard, or anything like this. This is just, like I said, my personal view, and you can hold whatever views that you want to on the subject. Now, I believe that evolution and at least a form of creationism can be reconciled. I have no difficulty accepting the fossil evidence from Africa about Lucy the first primate and Homo habilis and Pithecanthropus erectus and so forth. If you look at the facial and anthropological reconstructions of these early primate species, you will see quite clearly that these are the ancestors of niggers. I personally have no problem at all in accepting that the African Genesis theory is quite correct for niggers. White people and yellow people, on the other hand, came from somewhere else. Where? I have no idea, and I will not speculate. But if you look at white people, you look at African niggers and Australian Aborigines, and you look at pure Mongoloid peoples like Eskimos and Siberian natives, then there is no question that all of these are different orders of creation. And yet the only species for whom we have evolutionary evidence dating back millions of years are niggers. I think that niggers are probably the true homegrown earthmen, and if that makes liberals happy, fine. White people and Asians came here from somewhere else about 25,000 years ago, because that's when we first appear in the form of Cro-Magnon men, a people who were white and who had larger brain capacities than us. Then the Cro-Magnon disappear, and we appear in our present form many thousands of years ago in the area around Lake Baikal in what is now Russia, comparatively close to where the first Asians make their appearance in south-central China. Creation by one god? Many gods? Did we come from outer space and the chariots of the gods? Did we come from another dimension or a fringe-style alternate universe? I have no idea, and it's not relevant to the fact that we're about to lose this world as we know it when Benjamin Netanyahu launches his bombers against Persia in about 5 or 6 weeks. Normally, I'd say, knock yourselves out speculating, guys, but right now, I really do think we ought to at least try to pay attention to what's going on around us and not flee in terror from reality and politics like we normally do. Now, by the way, this is one reason that this program may sound a little boring compared with what it was a year ago, what with all the guest speakers and the panel discussions and all that we had back then. Now, I am genuinely convinced that the clock may be about to strike midnight once Netanyahu launches those bombers. And for the next couple of months, this show is going to be pretty grim. And it's going to be more of me talking than usual, because I think I'm going to have a lot more to talk about. For about a year, this show was largely entertainment, and I don't regret that at all. It was fun. But the fact is that I truly believe we no longer have that luxury. It's at least possible that the big blow is finally coming. I have some things I want to say to you between now and then, even if you do find my constantly droning voice a bit boring. Well, in order to break up the sound of that boring droning voice, here's a little something from the Top of the Pops back in the 12th century. From my Weird Aryan History series, this is the Divine Hildegard von Bingen. O vas nobile.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I would like to talk about the issue of earning a living. You know, one possible venue for a job or career is the avenue of elder care. There's a lot of elderly people that are in need of assistance, and yet they wish to stay in their homes, and as a result, they need help with things around the house or things such as shopping or someone to take them to the doctors. And if you're able to assist them, help them with the various things that they need in their daily living, then their families are very grateful, and you can also earn an income in this way. Now, you can work independently or you can work for an agency. In either case, there are always elderly people who are in need of help and who are grateful for those who are willing to have patience for this line of work. In the line of work of elder care, nobody is really interested in your opinions. Now, if you were looking after children, there might be some concern of who might influence a child, but when you're dealing with someone in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, you really are beyond those concerns, and the individual in question, the individual that you're caring for, really at that stage, elderly people tend to be mainly concerned with whether or not they're ambulatory, and they're concerned with their next meal, and they might want to hear nice little stories from you about how your life is going, but that's really all you have to do with them. And so if you were concerned with finding a job or establishing some sort of career where opinions really don't matter, I would have to say that is really one avenue. Now, another avenue for earning a living, and this is something that was recently suggested to me, is the avenue of earning money from rental property. Now, I don't know how we feel about this because I was recently reading a book about Ezra Pound, and in this book, Pound is said to be a follower of a man by the name of Douglas, who was against rentals because he felt it was a form of usury. However, although such ideas may be all well and good, the fact is that earning money from a rental property is a way for someone to separate themselves from dependence on an employer. And also, for us who are thinking of migration and we're thinking of potentially selling a property, another avenue, of course, is to rent the property instead of selling it. And in that way, it can become a long-term source of income. The other thing is that today we have software to monitor a property, so you don't necessarily have to live near the property that you're renting. So as I'm thinking of this possibility, I'm realizing, well, I don't have to be in the same state as the property that I might rent. I could move away and still potentially have a rental property that would income for me. You see, the reason that various outgroups and various minorities have at times become interested in investments such as properties and charging rent is because such groups often had a hard time finding employment, but you still need to earn a living. A rental property is one way to do that. So when I heard this advice, I really started to think about it, and I've been reflecting that it could be very practical. I think that we need that. I think we need practical advice about finances, because I think we've often been rather unable to deal with our finances, and I think that we need to. I think it's important for migration plans and also for life generally. I think that we need to be more cognizant of how we could earn a living. And so I hope this advice will be helpful to anyone, particularly people who are considering migration but are concerned about getting a job in the homeland, who are concerned about their income and their finances. So I hope you find this advice helpful, and I hope to be back soon because I'm reading a very interesting book that I would like to talk about next time. So I hope you enjoyed this week's installment.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who had previously been inserted into Steele's home, posing as a handyman to spy on the Steele family before any of this came up. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of gold and silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by the Democrats. The final whereabouts of that gold and silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of this stolen property as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience he underwent of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. These tapes appear, even to a layman who first hears them, to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to state that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who, according to the Spokane Spokesman Review, was at the time being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life's savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money, and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that the second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. Certainly his performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he wouldn't even put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained, either to Ed or Cindy Steele, while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed somebody off really bad, although I don't see how. Ed had withdrawn from the Idaho governor's race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is being held in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. The staff and guards are issued bottled water to drink. The inmates are not, and are forced to drink and bathe in chemical-laden poison. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. It is time that Edgar Steele's voice was heard once again in the land. If for no other reason, then because the FBI and the Obama regime do not want you to hear it. This recording is from 2008.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's April 23rd, 2008, and this is a nickel rant entitled, A Rising Storm. What's the matter, Bunky? Having trouble making ends meet? Sick of the cost of everything going up while your income actually goes down? Laid off? House equity shot? Borrowed up to the gills with all your credit cards maxed out now? And now you can't even afford food, you say? Well, here's a big part of the reason why. $36,000 flows to each illegal alien family in America each and every year. Now, please go to the online version of today's rant and look at the three articles I have appended to the written copy of the rant. They're important. I'm not going to read them to you, but they're really integral to today's message. The first is a really excellent article by Phyllis Schlafly entitled, How the Government Spends Taxpayers' Money. Now, if $36,000 flowing to each illegal alien family in America doesn't sound like much, consider that with perhaps 80 million tax-paying households in America, yours being one of them, of course, each and every one of our households pays $4,325 each and every year toward that $36,000 that each illegal alien family receives. Did you net $36,000 after taxes last year? Well, neither did I. But they did. No wonder they keep flooding over that border. Wouldn't you? My son took my little girl to the local hospital emergency room a few weeks ago with a severe asthma attack. Pretty much a routine in-and-out affair. Used to be, that might cost $100, or about twice what a doctor visit might cost. Total bill this time, over $750. Well, guess why? Jose uses the emergency room freely as his doctor's office, because federal law requires our hospitals to treat his family there, whether or not they're able to pay. We already pay for Jose an increased insurance premiums, but we also pay for him when we dare to use the emergency rooms in outrageous charges. Now, I have a $5,000 deductible health insurance plan, which means that I provide my family insurance coverage only for catastrophic events. I can't really afford it, but figure that I can't be without insurance altogether, just as so many Americans have been forced to do without. That means I must pay my little girl's ER visit of $750 out of my pocket, just as if I had no insurance at all. Thanks, Jose. Jose's family is netting $36,000 after taxes, that they don't pay, of course, and getting free medical care. You and I net less and pay for Jose's free medical care that we can't afford. We can't afford to go to the ER anymore, folks, face it. In fact, we can't really afford medical insurance anymore either. All other things being equal, we might just as well nationalize all of America's health care. Socialized medicine would be better than no medicine, which is what so many of us now have, in effect. And now begin the reports about food prices skyrocketing and there being actual shortages in places around America. See the second article I've attached to today's online version of the rant, and it's entitled, Food Rationing Confronts Breadbasket of the World, and it's from The Sun, the online edition. And it talks about genuine food riots taking place in other countries. Jose gets food stamps for his family here, of course, and you can bet he's at the head of the line for Agricultural Department food handouts. And Jose gets to send his kids to college anywhere he wants, with no out-of-state tuition charges, and likely no charges whatsoever, since they get preference over our kids for grants and scholarships, not to mention admission. I can't afford to send my little girl out of state to the college she really wants to attend because of non-resident tuition charges. Idaho, as you might imagine, offers little in the way of higher education. And in L.A., there is that illegal alien girl demanding her third kidney transplant. And for that, see the third article that I've attached to today's rant, entitled Organ Transplants for Immigrants Stir Debate in California, and it's from the L.A. Times. She wants that kidney transplant for free, of course. Now, each of the prior two of hers cost $500,000 each, and so will this one. And because we did the first two for her years ago for free, we owe her this one too, she says. What's worse is that it looks like she'll get it. Meanwhile, many Americans on kidney waiting lists die for lack of a donor kidney. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm fed up with being a second or third class citizen in my own country with racial preferences pushing Negroes and mestizos ahead of my family, all while I am forced to pay for their good fortune. And my money is taken at a time that forces me and mine to do without because of the rising cost of everything. What's more, each of the three candidates chosen for us to, quote, vote, unquote, upon for president this time has pledged, if elected, to grant amnesty in one form or another to all these illegals. Less than 2% of illegal aliens are picking our crops. Yet, 29% are on welfare. That's acknowledged by our government, though grudgingly. The U.S. Senate voted to grant Social Security benefits to illegals beginning this year. 29% of inmates in federal prisons are illegal aliens, per FBI figures. Over 1 million sexual assaults are committed in America by illegals. And the L.A. Times reports that in Los Angeles, our largest city now effectively occupied by illegals, 95% of warrants for murder are for illegal aliens. 75% of people on the most wanted list are illegal aliens. 2/3 of all births are to illegal alien Mexicans on Medi-Cal, whose births were paid for by taxpayers. 25% of all inmates in California detention centers are Mexican nationals here illegally. And the FBI reports half of all gang members in L.A. are most likely illegal aliens from south of the border. 60% of all occupants of HUD properties are illegal. 21 radio stations in L.A. are Spanish-speaking. In L.A. County, which is L.A. City proper, 5.1 million people speak English, while 3.9 million speak Spanish. And what's more, illegals expect and demand to be taught in their own language, not ours. Illegal aliens expect, demand, and receive all manner of special privileges. Illegal aliens expect, demand, and are given affirmative action preferences in hiring, education, and government benefits. Illegal aliens expect, demand, and are given ethnic studies that glorify their culture and denigrate ours. Illegals expect and repeatedly are given full amnesty as a reward for their lawless behavior and unmannerly conduct in our country. We've given up our jobs to those less qualified. Our children have been sacrificed on the altar of political correctness. Our families do with less. Increasingly, more of us are hungry and even homeless, while the undeserving squalor of other countries feast upon the ever-decreasing bounty of America. We do without health care that we need because we cannot afford it, because Mexico's burgeoning offal demands and takes it for free. The retirement for which we paid Social Security taxes all these years now is being diluted and given to those who paid nothing for it. I, for one, am beyond being sick of it all. Do you hear that thunder in the distance? A bad storm is coming our way. Yes, folks, things are going to get ugly for us, no doubt about it. But things are going to become very, very ugly for you, Jose, when the payback begins. And then we will turn our attention to those of you among us who destroyed our culture by holding the immigration floodgates wide open. Street lamps throughout America will be festooned with the swaying bodies of politicians, plutocrats, bankers, and other assorted thieves, rest assured. New America, an idea whose time has come. My name is Edgar J. Steele. Thanks for listening.
This is an old folk rock group from the 90s called Cordelia's Dad. I've had a couple of people ask me to comment on the obvious racial aspect of the Chicago teachers' strike, which no one else in the news media will comment on. Sure, I think that's one purpose of a program like Radio Free Northwest, to say out loud what the rest of the media don't dare to say, even if we only have about 4,800 listeners per week in our audience. Now, for those of you who don't bother with system news media and politics, last week the teachers' union in Chicago went on strike for the first time in 25 years. The NEA, the National Education Association, which is basically the National Teachers Union, is essentially an adjunct of the Democratic Party nationwide, and as such, one would have thought that they were all completely in the tank for Obama. And so they are. So why are they striking now in an election year? I think part of it is for the same reason that Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel will be waiting until October for his attack on Persia, so that the government will be hopelessly entangled in the nets of the election and won't dare to do anything that might offend Israel and lose the Jewish vote and Jewish money. Now, the Chicago teachers are striking right now so that the Democratic boss of Chicago, one of Obama's Jewish handlers named Rahm Emanuel, won't dare to come down too hard on them and will give in quickly for the sake of peace before a crucial election in which the notoriously falsified and corrupt Chicago vote will be all important, just like it was for JFK in 1960 and Jimmy Carter in 1976. The key goal that the Chicago teachers are striking over isn't money, although they say it is. Now, that's kind of ridiculous, since the Chicago public school system has the highest paid teachers in the country and probably the world. The average teacher in Chicago earns $100,000 per year. They're allegedly balking over a mere 16% pay increase, but that's not the real reason. The real reason the teachers are on strike is that their abysmal record as educators has become so horrific that even the Democrat regime of Rahm Emanuel has to try and do something about it. 44% of Chicago students who enter freshman high school never graduate. 85% of fourth graders in Chicago can't read on a quote-unquote age-appropriate level, which effectively means that 85% of all 9-year-olds in the Chicago school system can't read. Now, in public schools today, teachers and school systems live and die by standardized test scores. Federal and state money is allocated on the basis of performance that makes the NEA and hence the Democratic Party look good. The better your school's scores, the more money that school gets and more little gold stars the teachers get on their foreheads and the heavier their pay packets. The worse the scores, the less money you get and the more you're threatened with those twin terrors of the NEA. Performance-based teacher evaluation, and school vouchers, which will enable at least some kids to escape to non-unionized private schools and have at least some chance of actually getting some kind of education other than politically correct history, where niggers and women invented and did everything, and so-called self-esteem classes. What Emanuel and the Illinois State Board of Education are attempting to do is to introduce a very mild form of performance-based teacher evaluation that will enable them to either fire or at least threaten to fire some of the worst and stupidest nigger teachers in a last-ditch effort to get those scores up before the whole system falls apart. Of course, there are other ways. Now, I remember about a year ago in Atlanta when Sally and I reported on the massive fraud parties that the nigger teachers and principals were having, where they'd get together after school and on weekends and rewrite and rescore and falsify test results in order to get the Atlanta test scores up above the required level to keep the money flowing in. I won't go on, but the funny part to me about all this is that everybody in the country knows damned well that the real issue is race. Everybody knows damned well that the reason test scores in the big cities are so low is because these inner city school systems are largely black, both in their faculties and in their student bodies. And so they get a double whammy of one of the great facts of life. Niggers are stupid. This average difference of about 25 IQ points in innate intelligence is genetic. It is hardwired into blacks and most mestizos as well. It cannot be undone. It can't be fixed. You can't fix stupid. You can only fiddle the test scores like they did in Atlanta. Now, the whole education issue in this country is racial, and everybody is utterly terrified to say it out loud. It is complicated by the fact that the so-called inner-city students, these urban youths, from the age of 13 or so onward, are violent criminals who belong in a cage, not a classroom. They are thieves, drug dealers and drug addicts, gangbangers, killers. Their minds are deranged from the horrible diet of American junk food, which seems to affect blacks and browns in even worse ways than it affects whites. They are incredibly dangerous, and under existing rules of liberal society, it is completely impossible to discipline them or control their behavior in any way. Now, historically, the only way in which the white man has ever been able to control black behavior is through extreme force and violence, the lynching tree and the whipping post. With blacks, it is not just the severity of the punishment that counts, it is the certainty of punishment, and that hasn't existed for almost 60 years. Since we don't use the noose and the whip anymore, and since prison is actually black males home away from home where they're better fed and cared for than they are on the street, there is simply no way to solve the whole issue of racial crime and also poor academic performance by black students without forcibly controlling their behavior and punishing them with lightning severity when they disobey, which isn't going to happen. If the Chicago school system were to set up whipping posts on the basketball court and hold an assembly every day wherein a dozen or so of the biggest and most violent black bucks were strung up by their thumbs and flogged until their ribs showed through their backs, then that might be enough to get the black student body's attention and let them know that they will do what they are told, and they will sit at those desks quietly and memorize whatever crap the teachers need them to memorize for the tests, and that would get the test scores up. Maybe, so long as the test answers weren't too complex. But since we won't use the whipping post, the only way to get test scores up is to cheat, like they did in Atlanta, or to go on strike, like the teachers have done in Chicago, if it looks like there will be any attempt at all by the people with control of the money to withhold that money, or to discipline teachers in any way for failing to do what is basically impossible for anyone to do, let's face it, i.e. make niggers smart and teach them to do things as well as white people. I do actually have a certain amount of sympathy for the striking teachers because they can't do what the regime wants them to do. They don't have anything to work with. It's not possible. Always remember, the liberals and the so-called civil rights industry have never really wanted equality of opportunity. What they want is guaranteed equality of results, and that is biologically impossible. Our society has spent the past 60 years attempting to do something that cannot ever be done. Okay, time for another episode from my Weird Aryan History series, which is a collection of 56 emailed articles that I put together some time ago and which I still send out occasionally, about twice a year. I also put together two smaller groups of emails, by the way, which are a Jewish history series and a gay history series, but I don't want to take up valuable airtime on Radio Free Northwest talking about kikes and bugger boys. This week, I think it's time we really got back to basics. Horst Ludwig Wessel was a National Socialist hero during the Kampfzeit, the time of struggle from 1919 until the day of the German Revolution on January 30th, 1933. He was the author of the lyrics to the song Die Fahne hoch, which means Raise the Banner, usually known as the Horst Wessel Lied or the Horst Wessel Song, and that became the Nazi Party anthem. It was also Germany's dual national anthem from 1933 until 1945, along with Deutschland über alles. Wessel was born on September the 9th, 1907, in Bielefeld in Westphalia. He was the son of a Lutheran pastor, and his mother also came from a long line of Lutheran ministers. Although he was later portrayed by hostile, liberal, and Jewish sources as an illiterate thug, young Wessel actually had a pretty good education, and he was of at least average intelligence. The thing that's always struck me about Horst Wessel is not that he was this big street-fighting muscle man or Arnold Schwarzenegger type or larger-than-life figure, but the fact that he was so typical of his generation of Germans who were too young for World War I, but who nonetheless had to struggle for their national existence in ways every bit as important as Verdun or the Somme. In April 1926, Horst Wessel enrolled in the law faculty of Friedrich Wilhelm University in Unter den Linden in Berlin, and he appears to have been a satisfactory student until he decided to devote all his time to the Nazi movement. Wessel was politically active from a very early age. His father was a supporter of the conservative German National People's Party, and when he was 15, Wessel joined the DNVP youth group, the Bismarckjugend. He soon became a local leader, and he engaged in street battles with the youth groups of the Social Democrats and the Communists. By 1926, however, Wessel had grown too radical for the DNVP, and in December of that year, at the age of 19, he joined the Nazi Party and its paramilitary organization, the SA, the Sturmabteilung, the Brown Shirts. Until this time, the Nazis had been very weak in Red Berlin, but from 1926 on, under the energetic leadership of the new Gauleiter, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, the Nazis rapidly displaced the other parties of the right. Wessel was one of the wave of new young recruits that Goebbels brought into the party. Wessel soon impressed Dr. Goebbels, And in January of 1928, during the period when the Berlin city authorities banned the SA in an effort to curb political street violence, he was sent on a study trip to Vienna to study organizational and tactical methods of the Nazi movement there. In May of 1929, Wessel was appointed leader of SA Troop 34, which was based in the Friedrichshain district, where he was now living. In addition to his political activities, Wessel had some musical talents. He played the Schaum, which is a kind of oboe popular in Germany, and he founded an SA Schaumkapelle, or Schaum Band, which was used to provide music during SA parades and meetings and attract new followers. In early 1929, Wessel wrote the lyrics for a new Nazi fighting song, which was published for the first time in Goebbels' newspaper Der Angriff in September, under the title Der unbekannte SA-Mann, the unknown SA man. This was the song later known as Die Fahnenhoch from its opening line, or also as the Horst Wessel song. It was later claimed by the Nazis that he also wrote the music, but in fact the tune was taken from a World War I German Navy song. Probably it's originally a folk tune of some kind. In September 1929, Wessel met an attractive 18-year-old woman named Erna Janicki. Now, the usual litany of hostile sources have claimed that Erna was a prostitute, but no one has ever produced any actual proof of this allegation. Shortly after, he moved in with her at her apartment in Große Frankfurter Straße. Now, this may have contributed to the later slanders against Erna's character, since in those days cohabitation was still considered highly immoral. Now, the landlady was one Frau Salm, whose late husband, unknown to Wessel, had been an active communist. Frau Salm seems to have developed an active dislike for Wessel, and exactly why she would rent to a National Socialist couple living in sin, or why they would rent from a communist-connected landlady, was never clarified, but that appears to have been the situation. On the evening of January the 14th, 1930, Wessel answered a knock on his door, and he was shot in the face by an assailant who then fled the scene. He was gravely wounded, and he lingered in the hospital until he died on February the 23rd. His assassin was Albrecht Ali Hüller, an active member of the local Communist Party branch. The communists denied any knowledge of the attack, but, well, then they would, wouldn't they? And they said it resulted from a dispute over money between Wessel and his landlady. It's also possible that the shooting was revenge by the local communists for Wessel's alleged role in the murder by local Nazis of a 17-year-old communist named Camilo Ross earlier in the day. Later, romantic embellishment claimed that Hüller was the former lover of Erna Janicki, and the handsome young stormtrooper had stolen his girl. At this distance in time, frankly, it seems impossible to establish the exact details of what happened. Wessel was buried in the graveyard of his father's old church. 30,000 people lined the streets to see the funeral procession. Goebbels delivered the eulogy in the presence of Hermann Göring and Prince August Wilhelm of Prussia, the son of the former Kaiser Wilhelm. When the Nazis came to power in 1933, an elaborate memorial was erected over the grave, and it became the site of annual pilgrimages by the Nazis. With the fall of the Third Reich in 1945, the memorial was destroyed, and Wessel's remains were apparently disinterred and also destroyed. The gravesite itself has recently been rediscovered by amateur historians. The martyrdom of Horst Wessel led directly to the promotion of his song Die Fahnenhoch as the official song of the Nazi Party. From 1933, it was adopted as the unofficial second part of the German national anthem, to be played and sung immediately after the Deutschlandlied. The song was banned, along with all other Nazi symbols, in 1945, and both the lyrics and the tune remain illegal in Germany to this day.
Thank you.
These are the men that we once were. These are the men that we can be again one day, if we will only change our thinking and recover our ancient courage. Before I go into my closing monologue this week, I want to comment on something that just happened yesterday, September the 11th. The United States ambassador to Libya, a career State Department employee named Christopher Stevens, was physically dragged from his hiding place in a so-called safe house in Benghazi by an angry mob of Libyans, and either suffocated or stomped to death, depending on which version of events you believe. Right now, there are several versions, which will presumably coalesce into some kind of official storyline soon. In that part of the world, I think it's reasonable to assume that Stevens had CIA connections. Three other Americans were also torn to pieces by the mob. These are the same Libyans who, lest we forget, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, quote-unquote, liberated a few months ago from that awful man Gaddafi. Gee, during the 42 years Gaddafi was in power, I don't remember any American ambassadors being lynched. Although Ronald Reagan did send the bombers to kill Gaddafi's 6-year-old granddaughter once. Whole B-52 raid to kill a single child, just like Bill Clinton once fired a whole cruise missile to kill a teenaged Iraqi girl who was the receptionist at the Baghdad Sheraton. True stories. Anyway, where was I? The crowd in Benghazi was enraged by a newly released movie, made in the U.S., of course, but produced and directed by an Israeli Jew named Sam Basili, a film that insults the Prophet Muhammad by portraying him as a fool and a religious fake, and also by depicting him having sex with a woman. Now, this with a religion that considers any image at all of Muhammad to be blasphemous. Okay, first off, I think we all know damn well that everyone involved in the production and distribution of this anti-Muslim movie was perfectly well aware of the effect that it would have, especially in view of past experience down through the years when even a Danish newspaper cartoon depicting Muhammad caused riots. Now, this kike can't possibly claim ignorance of what he was doing. This was deliberate. I assume that the timing of this movie's production and distribution indicates that it's part of Israel's attempt to raise the temperature and gin up sympathy for an attack on Persia by inciting to incidents of the kind that took place on September 11th in Libya and Egypt. But let's not get into all that for now, because I don't view this episode in a Middle Eastern context, but in an American one. What strikes me is that here, although it's in a foreign country, we have the first example of a scenario which is going to become all the more common as the years go by, and which is America's worst nightmare. Now, have you ever noticed how when you're upset with some stupid act of law or bureaucracy or capitalism, or when you're getting fucked over by the system in some way, you can never find the right person to blame? And even if you can ascertain precisely who throughout this whole huge and diseased and flatulent system is actually responsible for a specific act of financial or legal sodomy directed against you or someone else, you can never actually get at that person. The people who are actually responsible for the collapse of the world we once knew due to the decisions they have made and the personal behavior they have indulged in are always carefully isolated from the real world and from real people. They're surrounded by security and bodyguards and air-conditioned limousines and private jets and mansion estates guarded by closed-circuit TV cameras, razor wire guard dogs, and armed mercenaries. They are fortified and insulated behind walls of concrete and steel and bulletproof glass on the high floors of buildings from which these responsible people, in their expensive suits, look down on the rest of us through tinted windows. And those floors are only reachable by special private elevators with locking codes and security measures designed specifically to keep normal people who may have been fucked over away from the perpetrators who actually caused it to happen through their decisions. The people who actually make the mess, the people who lie on television talking head shows, the people who sit in the mahogany-lined boardrooms munching organic crap while disposing of billions of dollars and millions of people, the droids who crunch the numbers and who decide who's kept on and who's laid off, the men and women who will soon decide under Obamacare who is sufficiently valuable to Democrat society to merit what degree of health care, and who, on the other hand, will be given a few pain pills and kicked out the door, the people who control the money, the people who make and enforce the laws, the lawyers in their $5,000 suits and $995 tooled leather briefcases, the judges in their black robes, the multinational executives and politicians and bureaucrats who ride in limousines and sit on brick patios in exclusive places, sipping Chivas Regal with a twist, the people who move you like a chess piece in a game and who will sacrifice you and your family just as quickly. Have you ever noticed that it's almost impossible to ever actually identify these people? And if you do, it's even more impossible to get at them? Not even to talk to them, never mind anything rambunctious like those guys in Benghazi. These people who make the mess that we have to live in do not acknowledge that you exist, and they resent the hell out of being forced to do so. I would imagine that was probably more or less the dying thoughts of that American Ambassador Stevens while those Libyans were whooping up on him. Just a few months ago, he was ordering massive airstrikes on their country from American aircraft carriers, and this is the thanks he gets? American and Western society has become crackerjack expert at insulating the people who make the mess from the people who have to live with it. But in this case, for whatever reason, for the first time in a long time, somebody slipped up. And normal people, even if they were Libyans, actually, physically laid hands on one of the messmakers and physically dragged him out of his carpeted and air-conditioned room and out into the dirty street where he was actually punished for what he had done to them. Now, do you have any idea how revolutionary an event that is, in every sense of the term? The last time white people actually did anything like that was in 1989, when the Romanian people dragged Nicolae and Elena Ceausescu out of their helicopter and shot them dead in punishment for 30-odd years of ghastly tyranny. Now, the Ceausescus were ideological cousins to certain people in expensive suits who rule the roost in this country, whom I probably shouldn't name, since I'm sure the FBI agents and U.S. attorneys are really leaning down close to the speakers on their computers now, hoping I'll say something that by some incredibly acrobatic Tarzan-like stretch can be construed as inciting or threatening something or somebody or square dancing in a roundhouse, whatever they're going to make up. I don't blame them, though. If I were them, I'd be rattled too. My guess is that everybody in the federal bureaucracy who wears a suit that costs more than three figures is quietly shitting in his Armani boxer shorts or her black lace panties now. The people who get those direct deposits of taxpayer dollars every month to keep the serfs in line are capable of understanding the message of Benghazi, even if most of us are so stupid that we listen to Rush Limbaugh's version. The message is that this system's DEFCON just ratcheted up another notch. The mob with the pitchforks and torches is real, and this time they got one of the real thing, one of the guilty parties. An American in a suit. Okay, it's still not happening here, and white Americans don't have anywhere near the courage and the strength of character that foreign Muslims do. But the fact is that this time, it happened to one of theirs. One of their own was forcibly removed from his comfortable workspace, forced out into the light of day, and punished for his behavior. And that has to terrify our lords and masters. This time, all the security failed. The mighty lantern-jawed and buzz-cut jarheads of the United States by God Marine Corps couldn't save Christopher Stevens. And that is chilling news for those who rely on the boys and the girls with the badges to protect them from the consequences of their decisions and their behavior here in America itself. The mob with the pitchforks and torches isn't at their door yet. Probably won't be for a while. But for the 1%, Benghazi isn't in Libya. It's right down the street a few blocks, if you get my drift. The mob isn't on their doorstep yet, but it's just down the street. Or at any rate, it's a lot closer than it was on September the 10th. And I suppose I better shut up now before my tortuous circumlocutions fail me, and I accidentally say out loud what I really mean to say. Can't have that now, can we? Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Still is beating her.